Welcome to the Productivity Mastery Podcast, presented to you by myself, Stoyan Yankov, productivity and performance coach, keynote and TEDx speaker, and co-author of the Perform Methodology, and the book Perform, the Unsexy Truth About Startup Success. Join me on a journey to discover what some of the world's leading professionals do to be more productive, create peak performing teams, and build successful global companies. New episodes weekly. And now, enjoy today's episode. Welcome back to Productivity Mastery. We have a new brand identity and design for those of you who are watching the video. And I'm super grateful for episode 151 to be having a very inspiring guest. I had so much fun preparing for this episode, listening to Marilyn. Marilyn's the whore, if I pronounce it correctly, is somebody who's the CEO and founder of a company called Cosmic Centaurs. And I want to start our conversation there. What is Cosmic Centaurs and how did you come up with the name?
Yeah, absolutely. So Cosmic Centaurs is an organizational development consultancy, and that's very complicated words to say that what we do is that we help leaders who are looking at the organization and realizing that they can do more in order to help the organization deliver on its goals and create a better employee experience for their people. We help them to identify what is broken in their company, to come up with the plan to fix it, and then to actually fix it. Now, in terms of the name, when I started the company, that was back in April of 2020, a lot of the work that we were going to do, because that was the reality of the market then, was help people transition to remote work. Because for me, I had worked in remote teams before, but for 95% of the corporate world, this was completely brand new to them. And I was trying to look for a cool name. And I realized that everybody was going to be on Zoom wearing corporate shirts and pajama bottoms. For example, right now, for all I know, you are wearing Hawaiian shorts and flip-flops, right? And so I realized that everybody would be a centaur, which is a half man and a half horse. And the word cosmic means a lot to me personally, but also was a reference to the Zoom background that was kind of the first background that people use because it was the first one on the list where they looked like they were floating in outer space. And so it was a realization that from the pandemic onwards, we would all be cosmic centaurs. And it's not a very serious name. So I often get asked, like, but don't you think that people won't hire you? You know, your consultant is supposed to sound like McKinsey or BCG. And I always say that it's a great filter for people who don't have a sense of humor.
You know, when you were talking about the image that came to my mind was half human, half pajama pants. So it's kind of like a pajama centaur or something. Like, you know, have you thought about a pajama centaur?
Yeah, we've actually, we always have, every once in a while, we'll have fun with the DALL-E trying to get it to generate some weird centaurs. It's not very good at doing the, anyways, AI is not very good at doing these intricate things yet. Like it can't do hands or feet very well, but it also cannot do centaurs very well, sadly.
I love it. I love it. Marilyn, my sources told me that you have a very special relationship with your mother, which was influential in your development as a leader. And I wanted to maybe hear more about it.
I'd love to. I always say I'm only like the second edition, but the original version is my mother. So my mom grew up in Lebanon. From a rural background, she decided to study computer engineering in the 80s. So when she was at university, she was one out of six women in a class of 400. And computers were still a room back then. They were quite big. So it was quite pioneering of her to realize that that was the way of the future. And because she did that, she ended up also having a very, you know, fruitful career. She wrote software. She was the head of IT and the head of HR for banks through most of my life. And she was a single mom as of the time I was four. And so she worked a lot. And part of it was because she needed to sustain us, but also part of it was because she just loved to work. And so I grew up in a household, I always say, where work was a value, not a necessity. And she just loved interacting with people. She loved helping them to grow. She also loved to solve complex problems. And I grew up with that kind of role model. So I could only live up to that and try to do as well as she has.
Why did you decide to move to Paris?
Wow, that's a really long story. So I'm Lebanese Canadian. So I spent my childhood between Lebanon and Montreal. And then I went to university in Lebanon and I studied architecture. It was a good but a bad choice. It depends how you look at things. If you look at it from a decision-making point of view, I actually don't think the decision-making process was very sound. It was mostly like, oh, Marilyn, you're good at math and you like art. You should be an architect. But from an outcome point of view, not a bad thing. And so before I finished studying architecture, I realized that although I loved the subject matter, I didn't necessarily want to lead the life of an architect. And so I kind of looked around and tried to find a different path. And even before I had graduated, I joined this company in Lebanon that was called Keyword, which was a digital agency, small size, you know, growing. And then ended up staying there for 9 years. And in that kind of 9 years, the company really grew. We had a sister company, which was an e-commerce company. We fundraised. We had teams all over the world. And then halfway through my journey there, I decided that I wanted to go and maybe, as every Lebanese will at some point in their life, to potentially explore living somewhere else. And that's where how I ended up in Paris.
And then the story continued, just so we can kind of wrap up the whole story. Now you're in Dubai.
Yeah. So let me get you to the Dubai then. So I went to Paris. I spent nine years in this company. And in my time there, I grew. You know, I did data entry. Then I did project management. Then I led the project managers. Then I led the development teams. Then, and so on and so forth. And by the time I'd moved to Paris and a few years later, I was leading a really big part of the company that was spread between North America, Western Europe, and the Middle East. And we were doing a fundraising round, and I realized that I never knew what EBITDA meant. Like, I always had to Google this stuff before walking into a meeting. And my boss and my mentor at the time said, why don't you go and get an MBA? Because obviously with my architecture degree, it wasn't very helpful. I've learned everything I've ever done in my life through Googling it, you know, but at some point it's also good to get a formal education. So I ended up going and doing an executive MBA. Eventually later decided to leave the company. And one of the things that was very striking to me in my MBA was that everybody in my class hated their jobs. And that was because a lot of them came from really big corporates. I was doing an executive MBA. So these were people who are a bit older, usually kind of high up in the ranks of larger organizations, of traditional industries. And I was very surprised because to me, my whole life work was a playground. I absolutely loved going to work. And so I said, what happens? Like, what happens when you grow and scale that people start to lose their connection to the meaning of the organization and why they're there? And so I thought that I was interested to see the corporate world, even though I didn't think I would survive there for very long. And so I moved from Paris to Dubai to join a really large company here called Emaar. It's the biggest real estate developer outside of China. They're the guys who built the tallest tower in the world, the biggest mall in the world, the biggest dancing fountain in the world. I had put a rule that I wanted to join a company that was more than 20 years old and had more than 3,000 employees, just to kind of experience it from the inside. And that's how I ended up in Dubai. And to come full circle to Cosmic Centaurs, in my time at Emaar, I did a lot of things. I always joke that it's my Charlie's Angels job because the chairman would just say, because I was working for the chairman of the company, and I always, you know, almost, he would call me and be like, today, Angel, you know, this is what you have to figure out. I did a lot of things, but the two big roles that I played was I was the chief marketing officer of the group for a year, and then I was the CEO of the Dubai Opera up until the pandemic. With the pandemic coming and the opera, of course, shutting down temporarily, I was fired towards the end of March. And then I went home and then we were on lockdown. And so it was sitting there on lockdown after about 3 days of resting where I was like, okay, well, I'm sitting here. What am I going to do? I'm going to start a company. And that's how I started Cosmic.
Super interesting reflecting and listening to your stories, because today we're going to talk about decision making and going backwards and listening to your decisions. But actually, I want to start there. Like, when did you become interested in studying decision making, and what were some of the early kind of inspirations? Like, did you read a book? Did you have a course at your MBA that kind of led you into, wow, we need to get better in understanding the process of decision making?
That's a really good question, actually. I think that on the one hand, let's go back. Everything will start with my mother, but my mother being an engineer, and it's funny, both a very rational and a very emotional person. She always tried to, even when I was making basic decisions about, you know, myself as a teenager or as a child, or even when she was making a decision on my behalf, unlike maybe a lot of parents, I don't know, she was very special in that she actually took time to explain the why. She always did. It was never like, because I say so. That was never the answer. And so from a very early age, I was trained on this idea that there is a good reason behind the things that you do. You know, you might turn out to be wrong, but at least you've thought about it. And so the process of being, let's say, intentional about decisions, I guess, is something that was culturally ingrained within me for a very long time. Now, in terms of my kind of more structured interest in decision making, I cannot remember the year, but many years ago, I stumbled upon this blog that turned into a lot of things that's called Farnham Street, where, you know, the founder of the blog, Shane Parrish, I think he used to work for like the Canadian CIA, I forgot what it's called. And in an organization like that, of course, decision making can sometimes be life or death. And so he ended up leaving the organization, but he was very focused on helping people make better decisions. And so he's been, I don't know how many, maybe more than a decade for sure, he's been animating this blog and later published books and conferences to support people to make better decisions. And actually, I went to one of their decision making conferences in February of 2020. So that was my last trip before the pandemic, believe it or not.
Okay, and then you got fired from the opera and then you have to make a decision.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was a very easy decision, that one, because I was fired. I was sitting at home. The world was full of uncertainty. I wasn't going to go back and try to find a job, because that it wasn't the right time to do that. Nobody had a clue how long we would be sitting there, what we would be doing, you know? And one of the reasons why it was an easy decision too. So on the one hand, like, there was so much uncertainty that there was nothing better to do than to start something new. Because actually, if you look at the data, you know, for example, more than 50% of Fortune 500 companies were started in an economic downturn. So we all know, you know, the word for crisis is, I think I'm going to say in Mandarin, but I don't want to mess this up, is the combination of, you know, crisis and opportunity are always together, right? So if you look at kind of the wisdom of the past, crisis are the right time to do something different. And so from that point of view, that was easy. And what was also easy, and I'm very privileged to be able to say that, and I recognize that, was that because I had just been let go from like a corporate job, I had savings. And I got a tiny bit of a compensation at the end, where it wasn't enough that I could be like, okay, I can chill for the next 3 years, but it was enough that I could take, let's say, a 6-month risk, right? So I took my savings and I said, 1/3 goes to savings, 1/3 goes to investing, and 1/3 goes into the company. Of course, I kept a little bit to be able to pay for my expenses. And okay, that's the money I have. It'll last me this long. In 6 months, it's, you know, red or green, and we'll see what happens. So it was a relatively easy decision to make, because there wasn't a lot of alternatives, right?
Let's dive deeper into decision making. I shared with you prior to the podcast recording that the first time I got to study decision making was when I was asked by a client, can you do a workshop on decision making for my people, for my team? Sure, let's do it. And then, of course, you go and you start researching, what can I teach these people, right? So I bought this book, Decisive by Heath Brothers, which I found fascinating. And the more I started reading, the more I understood how little I know about decision making. And there were so many practical tools. I recommend everybody to check the book by Heath Brothers, Decisive, and all their other books, because they're fascinating. But I wonder if you can maybe, you've been studying decision making, you are consulting companies how to be better in decision making, and now you know a lot more than you used to. I wonder, what are some of the things that, let's say, businesses are not so good at in terms of the knowledge about how to make decisions?
That's a great question, actually. Look, it's always the fundamentals. And I'm always surprised by the fact that it's the fundamentals that people don't know. So if you Google decision-making process, every answer you'll get is more or less the same, more or less. They might call a phase something else, but here's what it says. Understand the decision. Find data. Generate options. Compare the options, right? Like there's a very clear, make a decision. By the way, decision-making doesn't stop at decision-making. Implement the decision. Look at the outcome and go back and learn what you can learn, right? Like that's kind of the basic decision-making process. And when you look at how decisions are made, I'll like every step of this process, there are mistakes. A simple one. So let's say you want to make a decision about whether your business should invest in a project. We tend to think of the decision is either yes or no. But actually, the decision is never that, because with that money, you could be investing in other options, right? So if you first frame the question in the wrong way, then for sure your decision is going to be a bad decision. So first one. Second, data. Human beings are really bad at data. It's not in our construct. We don't understand it very well. Very few of us are actually trained to unpack data. So for example, I have rules for like analyzing data. One of them that I always use is averages are for suckers, because we always look at an average. And if you look at, for example, the average internet penetration in the Middle East or in Africa, it'll probably say something like, I don't know, 65% maybe. And that's pretty bad, right? But then if you unpack the average and you look at the UAE or Saudi Arabia versus other countries, the UAE and Saudi Arabia almost have 100% internet penetration, which is higher than the UK and the US and all of, you know, a lot of the Western countries. So we aren't good at looking at data. And when we do look at it, we are not good at understanding the stories behind it. So the other thing that organizations are relatively bad at is, what data is relevant? Can I be skeptical about it? And more importantly, can I tell the story of what this data is telling me? And I think they don't combine enough qualitative and quantitative data, and they don't combine enough internal and external data. So I will always find that companies have a bias, for example, towards qualitative external or towards quantitative internal. And the truth is, nothing, no framework, no process, no piece of data will ever give you a full view of the world. It's about combining all of that. It's almost like a Rubik's Cube, right? Like you want to keep turning it so that eventually you get some form of an answer. But obviously it's not overkill. You don't want to spend 6 months looking for data. But when you are spending even a few hours, you want to make sure that you're combining a lot of different sources and ways of looking at it so that you can feel like you collected enough data to inform a good decision, right? And then the next thing that happens is they forget to generate options. So like I said, they tend to focus on yes or no, zero or one. And in the decision-making process itself, so Farnham Street has an incredible book, and it's all published anyways on their website, for using mental models to look at a decision. We can spend time on it. I'm a bit of a geek. I could have this entire hour to talk about this. I'm happy to stop and kind of discuss this. But there are very basic, common, reusable decision-making models like, for example, second order effect or inversion or so on and so forth, like we could explore them together if you're interested, that you can apply to a decision to ensure that you're making the right one. And then I'll say the last thing, besides the fact that you need to decide and implement, and we know that that's often not very well managed in organization, like there might be a good strategy, but no one implements it properly. I think the other mistake that we make is to judge a decision by the quality of its outcome. You can make a good decision and have bad outcomes, and you can make a bad decision and have good outcomes. You cannot judge the quality of your decision by whether the end result was what you expected it to be or not, because there are so many things you don't control. So you need to judge the quality of your decision by the quality of your process. And sometimes you get unlucky and it doesn't turn out well.
That was such a good framing of the whole decision making. So now we can dive deeper into the different topics. I have so many questions already, yes. Marilyn. And by the way, those of you who are watching us live, make sure to tune in. And if you have a question that you want to ask about decision making, please post it in the comments. So I just want to start with framing the question. It's connected to the zero and ones and the options in many ways, because, you know, from my work, from you know, I travel a lot, I meet a lot of leaders, I get to work with many of them, and I'm curious to hear if you have the same experience, but many leaders in organizations, top-level leaders, they're fast decision makers. They love to move fast. They're ambitious. They want to, let's go, let's move. So often when they have an idea or they hear this new strategy, they were at a conference, they had a board meeting, whatever, they want to implement it right away, yesterday, right? You know, even in, I don't have the English version, but this is the Spanish copy of our book, Perform. We talk about, in the chapter of focus and execution, we talk about one of the enemies, the villains of focus and execution, is the shiny object syndrome, right? Like the new thing is so cool. Let's just do it yesterday. And I wonder if that's part of the challenge for leaders, is like, there's this cool new idea, let's just move. Why take the data? Why investigate the options? I mean, it sounds amazing. Let's just go.
Okay, I have a long answer to this. And it involves three frameworks. So part of making a good decision is deciding when you need to make the decision, right? And there are a couple of really helpful frameworks. So the first one is the Eisenhower matrix. So Eisenhower was an American general, later a president. And he had a very simple rule to decide when to make a decision, but also whether he should be the one to make it at all or whether it should be delegated. And it's a simple 2x2, and it's urgent, important. So if something is urgent and important, you do it immediately. If something is important but not urgent, you schedule the time to be able to go through the process. If something is not important and urgent, you delegate it, because it's not important to you, but someone else needs to do it now. And if it's neither of those things, you either drop it or schedule it for whenever, which is probably never. So first is it urgent or important? I think the second one is the Jeff Bezos one, which is it consequential and reversible? So, or irreversible rather. So if it's a really big, important decision and it has a lot of consequences, and at the same time, if you make that decision, you can never go back, it's relatively irreversible, then that's when you stop and pause and explore scenarios and get data and conduct research, because A, you can't change your mind, and B, it has a lot of consequences. If it's consequential but reversible, you still collect the data, because again, it's a big decision. So for example, if you see a new shiny object and the cost of working on it is a few days, or the cost of working on it is taking all of your team and repurposing them on this new vision that you have, those are not the same level of consequence, right? And then of course, inconsequential, reversible or irreversible. So if it's inconsequential and irreversible, you could flip a coin, it doesn't matter. Like, you could go and try it, no problem. It's not a big deal. And then the last one is a bit more complex, and it's called the Sinofian framework, but it's more about the environment within which you're making a decision. In the sense that if the environment within which you're making a decision is relatively predictable, then you can make a decision from a place of best practice, right? Like, if you're able to, if it's a, you know, there's a correlation between the input and the output, some degree, it's deterministic, then you can make a decision from researching it, from looking at what others have done, from looking for the data. But if you are in an emerging space, so the pandemic, for example, was emerging, it was unpredictable, it was chaotic, we couldn't really tell what was going to happen, you may not be able to rely on past data to make a decision, and you're better off deciding by doing. So in some case, you're better off deciding by strategizing and researching and et cetera. And in some environments, you could spend another 2 years collecting data. It's not going to tell you what's going to work. You have to try it out. So, and there's more, I'm sure, but these are three of the ones that I like.
No, I like it. And by the way, we love frameworks, and our listeners love frameworks because it makes your life simple. And I also love that you are adding this to the equation that sometimes the best decision is to make a decision fast because the situation requires it. So it's very individual, but for the most part, we know when we are too fast to make a decision. We know that, you know, oh, I really want to go with this. And then your team is like, hey, slow down, man. Like, let's have a, like, nothing's going to happen if we make the decision in a few hours, but we'll have a lot more, a lot better look at all the options, right? And just to get back to this, I listened to a podcast with Tim Ferriss.
Yeah.
He was talking about decision-making because he's also struggling sometimes with the shiny object syndrome, and his team knows that. So what he does, and I'm paraphrasing, so I'm not sure it's 100% the way it is, but he does the blue team, red team exercise on himself, meaning, and I think it was also one of the strategies mentioned by the Heath brothers, is he comes up with this idea for this new project, and then he becomes the blue team. It's like the military exercise, training exercise, right? He becomes the blue team. I need to defend that this is such a good thing as opposed to all the other opportunities that we have lined up, and my whole team needs to challenge me. My whole team becomes the red team. They need to penetrate and attack and make sure that, why is that not going to work? And if I manage to defend it, then we move with it.
Yeah. I definitely, I was going to say, even I struggle with the shiny object, but also the need for speed. You know, coming to Dubai and starting a company here, Dubai is an incredibly fast-paced place, right? Like, if you think that they have built what you see today in 50 years. So my mother was born before this country was born. And this country managed to, I mean, just Google Dubai and look at it, right? And so you are in an environment that is emerging where actually speed of implementation matters more than how much time you take to make decisions. And so I'm always influenced by this. I always say if I had started my company in France versus Dubai, I would have a very different company because my environment is also pushing me towards the desire for speed. And I myself sometimes, you know, will have to be like, okay, but do we really need to do this? Not so much because of the shiny object. I'm less influenced by that, but because of the need for speed. And when you start a company, you know, like mine, and I'm not doing like a hyper growth company, so I don't always have a good story to tell every 3 minutes, right? Like in the early days, for sure, if you spoke to me every 3 weeks, I would have been like, and we did this and we did that and here's the progress. But as the kind of the company evolves, it naturally slows down. We're a service company in the end, right? Like we're not building a software as a service or the next, you know, Amazon or and I'm sitting here and I'm like, I always wonder, like, are we moving fast enough? Like there's that balance between we need to slow down. That's the whole idea, because now we have a process, we have a framework, we have an approach. It's okay that we're not inventing a new thing every 5 minutes. But are we slowing too much? And I think entrepreneurs always live in between those two worlds of wanting to continue to push the innovation and the speed, and also understanding, even though they don't like it, that, okay, they also need to slow down in order to be able to scale. So it's really, it's a very difficult paradox.
That's such a good point. There was this famous quote by the former LinkedIn CEO, which was something about if you're not embarrassed by your product when you launch it, then you're probably doing something like, so that's one side of the equation, which is like, if we set this short deadline and if you just go ahead and do it, then it's going to be messy and so on, but we're going to get feedback so fast so we can readjust and adapt, and then we will have much better data to make decisions. You know, many founders are listening to this podcast. Some of you guys are tech founders. You are very slow in decision making. You love everything to be super, you know, adjusted and adapted. You know, I don't know, Marilyn, you probably work with startup founders. Sometimes you're like, did you guys start calling customers and presenting what you guys have as a solution? No, but it's not perfect yet. So, yeah. What is not perfect? You're building something and you never talk about anybody if they want it. Like,
I agree. Maybe, I was even my younger years very guilty of that, very guilty of wanting to make it perfect. And I see that often, but less where I am. In Dubai, it's the opposite. People will start talking to you about something, they got nothing. You know? But that's just cultural also, I think.
Have you used the Clifton Strengths Finder in your work?
No, I haven't. But I know
so this is it's a really good test. I recommend everybody. It's made by Gallup. I think it has more than 28 million data points. But so it gives you, out of 34 traits or talents, I would say it's more talents than strengths. They call it Strength Finder for marketing purposes because it sells more, but it's really your talents, your natural talents. So in my top five, to give you an idea, I'm having these type of traits. One of them is strategy. Mm-hmm. So we love to see the different options to find the fastest way to get somewhere. We love it, right? But I also have activator, which is kind of, let's move and then we'll figure it out on the way. and I also have focus, which means stay on track, you know, define the priorities, let's go. Don't get off track. And I have futuristic, which is like ideas about the future, you know, but what if we do this? and then I have self-belief, which is you trust that whatever you decide is going to be the right thing. So it's, for me, it's this constant, you know, there's like three people inside myself, like the inner voice is like, let's go. No, let's strategize. Let's do. So it's, I totally relate to what you're saying. It's like, are we moving too fast? Are we making decisions too fast? But then are we too slow? Like, because we are overthinking maybe. And usually it's the leader who's the fast decision maker. And that might be a little bit more than the rest of us, the rest of the people on the team. But then it kind of balances out because the people who need more time to be deliberate and to see all the details. And so I don't know, how do we find the right speed to make decisions?
That's a tough one. I can't say that I have an answer to this at all. I think you experiment. This is it. You never know what the right speed is. As long as you know, you can always control the process. You can't control the outcome. As long as you feel like when you looked at this decision and decided how fast to make it, because as I said, deciding when you need to make a decision is part of the decision. So if you said this decision needs to be made today and you had good reasons to say that, then that's the right speed. It's the best you can do, right? Is to try and decide what is the right speed. You might have turned out to be wrong. Okay, you will learn from it and you will evolve, but it's a constant iteration game, I think.
And one of the challenges in teams, you're working a lot of organizations in teams, is the clarity around decision making. You know, I'm getting into roles and responsibilities, but it's like, to what level of decisions I should not talk to my superior? And people struggling to know what is my decision making authority, right?
Yeah. I always say good decision makers are risk takers. So because if you're risk averse, you will default to the decision that is in line with your level of risk. I'm not saying risk takers like take all the money from the company and blow it on something stupid, but I mean that even if the hierarchy looks like it's not your place to make a decision or to push for it, a good decision maker doesn't care. And okay, then in larger organizations, they will leverage things like stakeholder management and negotiations and convincing skills and so on. But even if you think it's not your place, if you think a decision should be made and it should be made a certain way and you firmly believe it, ignore hierarchy. It doesn't matter. And so I think that that's something that often is a problem in organizations, that we accept the bureaucracy. And bureaucracy is great, by the way, like hierarchy is great. Hierarchy is useful for diffusing information, for bringing people together, for developing expertise, for creating multifunctional teams, whatever. I am someone who believes in structure, but I'm also someone who believes that 20% of the time, you can choose to ignore it if you really believe that a decision needs to be made. Just push through.
Love it. Love it. And I actually want to get into one of the other things that you mentioned. That was one of the biggest revelations for me from the Heath Brothers book. I need to be an affiliate to, you know, and get commission from selling the book.
You know, need an Amazon link here.
I need to reach out to the brothers and say, hey guys, hey, let's, but like one of the things that was really revealing, and you mm-hmm. mentioned it today as well, and I think I want to get there a little bit, is the concept of options. Mm-hmm. And the understanding, and in the book they keep on coming back to two options is not a choice. If you only have two options, you don't have a choice.
That's true.
So you need to generate at least three options, or even more, before you can make a decision properly. And I feel like too often in business, because we're busy, it's like, hey, we got this offer from this company. Should we do it or not? And it's like, well, maybe we should take a few more offers. Maybe we should negotiate. Like, there's so many more things to do before we can say yes or no. But it's like, we're busy, so should we do it or not? Well, maybe 10 more minutes or an hour or two will actually pay off, because we're going to get into a project with these people for 6 months. Is it worth it to spend half an hour, right? So talk to me about options, and how can we generate more options before we make a decision?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So there's a lot of different kind of ways to generate options. I think one that I really like is going back to first principles. So when we look at a decision and it's a yes, no, it limits us from thinking about why, right? So when you break something down into first principles, it means that you go back to the fundamental building blocks of that decision. So I don't know, let's take an example of a project. Let's say you're going to hire an agency to help you,
Participate. The book.
Great, market your book. And this particular agency is going to help you with a book tour. Like, let's be specific, right? Because these things are off. So then the question is, like, what are the fundamentals of this decision, right? I need to reach a specific audience. This audience are these people. Where are these people likely to be present? Is a book tour actually going to help us increase? So the fundamental of doing this is you want more people to become more relevant people, to become aware of your book and engage with it and the lessons that it teaches. Of course, you're hoping to sell the book, but you're also hoping to engage with them. Otherwise, you wouldn't be looking at a book tour, right? So when you break it down to the basic principles, if engagement is important, like you being there, talking, listening to people, selling your ideas, it's a very different first principle than I'm just trying to sell 3,000 copies, right? So if we take it down to this, then we can say, okay, what other way do I have of engaging directly if that is my goal? Maybe it's not a book tour at all. Maybe it's some other thing. And so one simple way to generate new ideas is, let's go back to the first principle and the building blocks of this decision and generate from there. You want to say something?
I saw you react. No, but this is the core sort of like principle I'm following, and some of the main idea behind this whole podcast called Productivity Mastery. It's about being intentional. And I catch myself sometimes, I get into a meeting or a conversation or negotiation, whatever, without having a clear idea what's the objective, what's the target, what's the final outcome. Like with the book, great example with the book marketing. What do we want to achieve? And in order to be clear what you want to achieve, you want to get things out of your head and say, well, from these 20 potential outcomes we can achieve, let's try to prioritize and see which one is with the highest importance. Selling 10,000 books, is that it? Is it building a community of 1,000 people that love what we do? maybe that's not about selling books, right? The book is the vehicle for us to build a community of HR people, and then we can impact their teams. I don't know, but
exactly. That's exactly right. And, you know, there's a lot of tools also. So now that you kind of can go back to that, to generate ideas, new ideas, there's a lot of tools, particularly for me from design thinking. So there's a great website. We can add it in the comments. It's called designkit.org, I think. And it's just a really nice summary of all of the design thinking tools that you can use. So tools for data collection, but also tools for ideation. And it can go from as simple as, you know, expert-led intuition, like you already know the answer and you're just going to generate it, but also going back, talking to people, exploring, finding data, looking at what has worked and what hasn't. So it can be kind of as short or as long as you want it, but there's a lot of really great tools in there. And generally, these tools are used for, you know, designing user or customer-facing things, but for example, in Cosmic, we use those same tools to design employee or staff-facing solutions because that's where, you know, that's the realm that we play in. And so you can very freely repurpose them for any decision you're trying to make, I think.
And I just want to add a couple of other very practical, I'd say, questions on the options piece. You know, how do we generate more options? One good question that was recommended in the same book was, what would you do if you cannot apply the two options that you had in mind?
Yeah.
So you have to generate more, like these two options, no go. You can't do them, right? So then it forces you
out of it. Yeah.
And then like the second one.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, the second one was when you're stuck to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we are when we're very good in giving advice to our people, right? But we're not so good in making a decision ourselves. And so they recommend the question. I've actually used it many times. What would you do if you are advising your best friend?
Yeah,
it wasn't the decision. Like, your best friend is going through this thing. What would you ask them to do? And usually no, right? But because it's you, we don't want to make that.
That is very true. We're always much better at helping others make decisions than make our own. I'm certainly number one person to respond to that. Yeah, there's a lot of other frameworks I've seen in facilitation. For example, one of them is, okay, those are your first two options. Now generate six more. And those need to be like bolder ideas. And after you're done with the six more, how about one extra really crazy one? Like, you know, so there's a lot of ways to kind of push your elasticity. What would you do if you have 10 times more money? What if you do if you had, so kind of putting yourself in outlier situations is another way of generating new ideas. There's a lot of really cool frameworks around that if you struggle with idea generation. I always say it's always good to just spend time listening to the market, to the people, or whoever is going to be impacted by that decision. Go talk to them, spend time with them. See what happens, see how they experience the world. It's a very simple but very effective way of generating new options.
And you are talking a little bit about gathering more data, which is my next question, because I think that's very interesting. How do we collect data effectively?
That's a really great question. So let's start with the tools again. So you have data that is what you would call primary research, meaning it's research that you generate, and generally like the most common tools. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with using the common ones. You don't always have to innovate on everything. Our interviews, surveys, focus groups, you know, internal reports, internal data, like anything that you as an organization or a team or a person can create that is not already available in the world. And then there's your secondary research, right? So essentially Google it, you know, reports, external data, research that other people have already published, right? And while this might be controversial, because ChatGPT, of course, is full of a lot of flaws, I find these days that ChatGPT is a great place to start. Please note that until, you know, ChatGPT for now is limited to data until 2021, and invents things all the time, because actually the purpose of generative AI is not to tell you what data, it's not a data research tool, it's to create new content, nonetheless, it's a great place to start because you can go and ask it the question and it'll generate both data sources, some of them invented, but some of them real, and options. ChatGPT is an incredible brainstorming buddy, you know, someone to talk to and be like, how would you, what are the possible options that I could, you know, generate off of this decision? And it'll start you somewhere. Now, how do you do it effectively? I think, you know, if we go back to some of our matrices from before, it's first you decide how much time you're willing to allocate to data collection. A week, 3 weeks, a month, right? Like, then you decide what are the key questions you want to answer, but also, and this is very much inspired from the scientific method, you must have a hypothesis about some of the answers. So what I mean by that is, if I asked you this thing about the book tour, I say, go do data. You could spend 6 months researching the effects of book tours on X, Y, and Z. But you must have a hypothesis about whether it works or not. And so rather than go and have a universal approach to data collection, you can start by saying, this is what I believe, like this is what scientists do. And now I'm going to go and try to find the data to prove or disprove what I believe. And so that kind of allows you to narrow down. And something that I also do is, I wish I had a data point that said this, like I literally write the invented data point that I want. And then I try and go and see if it exists or not. And that allows you to just narrow down the field a bit, because otherwise you could get lost in data collection.
Marilyn, one of the things that will stick with me from our conversation, a lot of great insights and frameworks, but I think it's something that many of you listening will also maybe have to get reminded about, is defining how much time we set to make a decision. And sometimes we might have it in our heads or not, but are we on the same page with the people that we work with about how long we will allow ourselves to make the decision?
Exactly.
That's so powerful.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, this is something I didn't say earlier, but recently I was in a conversation with someone who just recently left their role and is giving themselves time to decide what they want to do next. And they were telling me, and so I said, do you have a deadline for yourself? And they said, no, you know, it's because I want to like give myself time. I'm like, that's okay. The deadline can be in a year. A deadline doesn't have to be close. But if you don't have a deadline, here's what's going to happen. Your life will make the decision for you, because you will get a freelancing thing here. You will do it. You will get some nice consulting job with a bit of money here. You will take it. You think you're still making the decision, but in reality, the absence of a decision is a decision, right? And you will find yourself 5 years from now still not having made the decision, right? So I think it's very important to have a deadline. You can get to it and say, I'm still not ready. I'm going to push the deadline forward. That's fine. But at least there was a timeline within which you knew you needed to make a decision. And another kind of little piece of nuggets around decisions that we didn't say, and it probably should have been the first thing I say. I don't know if you know this, but the origin of the word decision is the same as the word scissor. The sis part means to cut things out, not to add things. So we often think of decisions as like, I'm going to do this one more thing. I'm going to decide this. But actually, because it's about generating options and cutting them down, think of the word of the root. That's literally how your brain should work. But setting a deadline to go back to that is really so important.
It makes me think also about the number of decisions we can properly make. And one other struggle for entrepreneurs and business leaders is the decision fatigue, when we are given too many decisions to make, and many of them are important and urgent. And we all know all these kind of famous stories of whatever, Mark Zuckerberg, and that will wear the same kind of t-shirt every single day of the week. So he doesn't have to make a decision. What, you know, Elon Musk was on the Joe Rogan podcast and he asked him, dude, why are you renting a house? You know, he's renting. He sold his house and he's like, because I'm a optimizer. If I have my own house, I'll have to make decisions how to optimize it every day. Should I bring people to Mars or should I optimize my house? So it's a...
That's a really great point. And I even I suffer from it. And actually recently, as a personal anecdote, we want to put our daughter in a nursery next year. So I have an 11-month-old. And you know, my husband, he's wonderful with this stuff. So he has a spreadsheet and comparisons and whatever. And I'm like, really not. I mean, I go to him with the visits, but I'm not actively participating in this decision. He's like, so? And I'm like, it's inconsequential and reversible. I don't care. and it makes me sound like, not a caring mother, but in the sense that I have a tiny company and I have a million decisions to make every day. Actually, I don't know if you know this number, but we make as humans 35,000 decisions every day. Now, of course, many of these are run by a kind of our infrastructure without us ever surfacing them to our consciousness, but we make 35,000 decisions a day. So being clear on the ones that aren't worth it, and I sound like a shitty mother for saying this, but it's just a nursery. She's going to go, she's going to play. She may like it. She might hate it. If she hates it, we'll take her out. Not a big deal, you know? So I definitely think that sometimes being comfortable with saying, this is a decision I am not going to make, right? To your team, to your family, and I need to take this off my plate. It's all entirely yours. And whatever decision you make, I will not be upset because I chose not to participate in it. It's so important because you really get overwhelmed. And in one of my previous jobs, my first one, I'm a really good decision maker in the sense that I make decisions really fast and I have a process and so on. And so my team would constantly delegate their decisions upwards to me. And so I will never forget, every few weeks I had this paper that said I have decision-making fatigue, and I would put it on the door of my office and close it and be like, today you do not get to delegate your decisions to me. I am out.
There's multiple studies. I know you love studies, Marilyn,
yes,
about the decision-making, how our ability to make decisions is going to drop when the more we're making decisions, which is one of the job of the leader, to be able to prioritize what decisions are important for her or him to make and what decisions to delegate, meaning you need to build a team that you're feeling comfortable to delegate these decisions of. But I want to actually wrap up because we're getting close to the end of this conversation. By the way, I want to say hello to Leon, who's joining us today and sharing a few words. He's also a performance and productivity guy and consultant. Make sure to check him out as well, Leon van der Laan. I hope I pronounce your name's great, Leon. Great points about decision making, he says. But I want to finish up, Marilyn, with a little bit about something that's a passion of mine and passion of yours, which is building productive but human centric workplaces, and maybe kind of to link the decision making to that. What can businesses improve when it comes to their decision making, so they can provide a great employee experience?
Yeah, that's a really great point. So actually, we at the end of last year, I think, we published an article in HBR, and again, we can share the link with your audience, about how to collect good data when it comes to employee-centric decisions. Oftentimes, you know, we will invest the energy needed to collect data from customer-facing decisions. So, you know, companies will do market research, they'll, you know, run experiments or campaigns and see what happens, and they really kind of make an effort there. They make an effort to understand that not every customer is the same and to treat them differently, but they won't do the same for their employees. And yet we know that within our employee population, there are individuals and there are groups that have shared needs, like a very basic, you know, element of, let's say, the employee experience is your benefits. You know, like I work for companies here in Dubai, they always offer parental support, like school fees. So when I was not a parent, I was essentially not getting any benefits because nobody in that team decided to think about, well, what about all these people, right? Like we're paying $20,000, $30,000 of extra fees for school, but 80% of our population actually never benefits from this. How are we going to think about it? And the reason that companies do that is it's overwhelming. right? It's a lot to go and understand everybody's single needs and try to make something that isn't, we call it one size fits none, right? But I think the first thing is a mindset change, which is a change of saying, I will care in the same way that I care about my customers, I will care about my employees, and I will take the time to talk and listen and collect data and make sense of it. And then I will make caring decisions. If you can just change your mindset that way, a lot of the rest will follow. And then I think also it's about, you know, earlier you talked about the shiny new things. I think with employee experience, we tend to focus on the shiny things because Google 25 years ago told us that having a ping pong table was important. But actually, the thing that impacts the employee experience the most is not the ping pong table, it's how we design work. So the highest predictor of employee engagement is their satisfaction with their role, their team, and their manager. Everything else is fluff, quote unquote. Obviously important, but fluff. So we don't also spend enough time thinking about the jobs we are creating. And that is the most important part of the employee experience. So going back to the fundamentals and saying, do I trust my employees? Do I know that they show up to do their best work every day? Yes, great. Okay, if not, fire them, by the way. If you don't think they're trustworthy, they shouldn't work for you. And then can I create a role and a job where they have autonomy to make decisions, where they don't feel like they're being treated like children, and where I trust that I've created enough data, information, upskilling, kind of managerial support that they will do their best work every day. I think if you just go back to those basics, you can do a really great job.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said. And by the way, Marilyn, I know you have a little more time, so I'm going to keep you a little longer than I promised because I know you have a meeting and you have so much more time. And Leon is coming back with us again. Oh, yeah, the shiny
Thanks,
things.
Leon.
This is so true. Fully agree with you, with your fluff point, Marilyn. And maybe fluff is probably a word, or maybe it's a nice to have kind of a different phrase in many ways.
It's like, a nice to have if it has real impact. So what I mean by that is that oftentimes what you also see is that organizations will tick boxes, but again, they haven't gone back to first principles, right? Why did Google want people to play? Because Google wanted them to stay innovative, not because it keeps people around in the office. Right? So if the reason you're putting in a play area in your office is that people never go home, that's the wrong reason, right? So what I mean by fluff is it's fluff when there isn't a first principle behind it, when it's you're just doing it because everybody else in our industry is doing it, or my competitors are doing it, or I read about it somewhere and it looks cool, and you haven't actually thought about, well, does this accomplish the goals of the organization? Because as much as I'm a hippie defender of the employee, someone said this to me once and it never left my mind. The most ethical thing a company can do is be profitable. What do I mean by that? If you are a financially sustainable company, you can support your employees, which by the way are your first stakeholder. You can support your suppliers, your customers. Yes, maybe make money for your shareholders. That would be nice too. But you're creating an environment of safety. And therefore, when you make decisions, that allows, by the way, your employees to innovate, because innovation means spending money on things you don't know if there'll be a good outcome. That allows them to think freely because they're not worried about their job the next day. So it's a very virtuous cycle to create a successful organization. And so when you're thinking about these things that you're going to spend the resources of the company on, be they money or people's time, right? Like if you send people on a 5-day workshop and that thing was just because the L&D person had it on their list that we should do design thinking this year and check and it's done, you're wasting everybody's resources. So that's what I mean by they become fluff when they don't have a good reason to exist. But even a ping pong table can be strategically meaningful if it's linked back to one of the goals of the organization.
Yeah, and as you said, caring for your employees sometimes means you have to fire the consistent underperformer. That's caring.
Yes, because, I agree.
Because you are responsible to ensuring a workplace culture that's productive, that's achieving results, where people feel like they belong. So you can't create this loose space, right? Like you have to find the right kind of balance. You know, people focus doesn't mean just chill. You know, like
we're
here for a reason.
Not at all. It means you make the hard decisions, by the way. That's why you get paid the big money, right? Like if you're a leader, your essential job is to make the hard decisions in addition to caring and nurturing your talent. And so if you're unable to tell somebody that they're not meant to be in this organization, then you're not a good leader.
But when Navid is saying hello from Dubai, you guys should definitely meet up. That's another thing. But one thing, so kind of the final topics I want to wrap up today is around, I recently had a guest. He was the LinkedIn's first chief HR officer, Steve Cadigan. He's also an author of a book called Workquake. So go check it out. But we had a really interesting discussion about the future of work, and he gave me a perspective of where he sees we're going. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious to hear your perspective. Talking about decision-making, many leaders today are trying to figure out in terms of the whole remote, hybrid, working from home, in the office, you know, mess and jungle. Yes. Like, mm-hmm. how do we decide, how do we make the right decision in terms of designing a workplace culture, model and rules that, you know, coming back to the two equations, are productive so we can achieve results and at the same time are focused on the people so they feel like they belong and they're part of this organization?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I always joke that the answer to every good question is it depends. Because as with everything, now that things have settled, the companies that choose to be fully in person versus fully remote has settled on a bell curve, right? Like simple. Now, there are so many complex factors that go into the decision of where people work from. I always say, first, you start from the strategy of the company. So what are we trying to build here? And then you kind of go down, right? Like I go back to fundamentals a lot. One of the reasons why companies exist, a fundamental reason why companies exist, is because they take a big task, they break it down, they give it to different people to accomplish, and they reintegrate it, right? Basic. This is what the engine of a company does. If being together is necessary, and by the way, there are frameworks to make these decisions. For example, if you're doing a complex work for the first time, it's better to be together. Like, we don't need to debate this. If you're doing repetitive work that is also individual, you can be wherever you want. That's why we outsource things like call centers, right? If you can outsource it, then it can be remote fully. The balance in the middle really lies on what you're trying to accomplish as a company, being intentional about when you do bring people together, because the worst thing that happens is you bring them back into the office, but they're having Zoom calls, but from the office. Great, you know? So being intentional about leveraging the co-location, making sure that it's productive. And there isn't a single answer that works even for all of your employee populations. One of our first clients was a construction company. So they're like, okay, I have 20% administrative staff. We can sit here and talk about flexible work for them. But actually 80% of my people are literally on the ground. So I think that my final answer towards this is the debate of location has polarized the discussion that should have been around flexibility. So actually, more people care about time flexibility than they care about location flexibility. Being able to start and finish when you need. And what this goes down to, if you think in first principles, is that people want to be treated like adults and they want to be given agencies over their lives. And on average, most people don't show up to work trying to do nothing. Most people. Like, and again, if you have people who show up to work to take advantage of you, fire them. But if you believe that people are there to do their best work and that you can provide them flexibility, and that can look like time flexibility, location flexibility, job sharing. Like, there are so many different ways you can provide flexibility. Then that's what you need to be thinking about. Not should we be at the office or not, right?
Excellent. Thank you so much, Marilyn. And final question, which is somewhat related to the topic. I would like to just hear from you. What would be your advice to, maybe reflecting from your own experience, how do we make decisions in times of uncertainty and crisis? Like, what would be your best advice? Maybe you can also include an example of you going through a crisis or from a difficult situation, or a leader that you've been working with going through difficult, uncertain times. Because the reason I'm asking this question is, first of all, we are writing a book about the topic, and I want to hear your perspective, eventually feature you. But secondly, 2023 is a very interesting year. The last couple of years have been very interesting, right? There's so much uncertainty. If you open the news now, you can read everything. We are in the middle of a recession. The economy is growing. People don't even know what's going on, right? So how do we lead in times of uncertainty?
I think, and by the way, I'm not the only person to think that, and I actually will draw on the wisdom of a book called High Output Management, written by Andrew Grove, the ex-CEO of Intel, who says that in times of uncertainty, and I really, really echo that, you cannot lead from a place of performance management. You cannot lead from a place of data. We talked about the Cinefin framework earlier. You have no best practices. You can't predict the future. The only place that you can lead from is a place of values. So you can go back to making your decisions that align with your values and your company's values when everything else fails, because the environment is so uncertain that collecting more data, as you say, only leads to more confusion. So that's my short answer. And I think even this today, even the smallest, you know, sometimes like in the corporate world, we wait until we're 100 people to write down our values. You know, like, so it's okay. We don't need them now. It's implicit. I think what the pandemic taught us, and I hope we all keep that lesson, is that there will always be cultural things that will remain implicit. It's called tacit knowledge. It's knowledge that you cannot make explicit. But wherever possible, making knowledge explicit, writing things down, communicate them often, integrating them into our decision-making. I would not be the same leader if I took my decisions with or without Cosmic Center's values. You know, we wrote our values when there was two of us. It doesn't mean they don't evolve and we don't re-explore them. But when I make a decision and we bring it up as a team, even today, like, okay, but if we do this, then we're not expressing compassion. What about our value of creativity? We bring it up in our decision-making. And I think it's the only stable thing in a world that is unpredictable and volatile.
I absolutely love it. And it's a great way to wrap up this podcast. Values are your compass for decision-making. And it should be. You know, if you make decisions driven by your values, aligned with your values, you're doing the right thing. No matter what, and not always going to work. You know, some companies are going to fail, unfortunately. Some, you know, but you're always doing the right thing. So, and once again, I want to say thank you to everyone who's been joining us live, listening to the podcast, who's listening to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, YouTube, you name it, all platforms. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to share with a friend, send it to your neighbor, show it to your mom, whatever works. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube. And we're going to keep bringing you amazing, fantastic guests like Marilyn. Final words from you, Marilyn. Where could people get in touch with you, find you, potentially work with you?
Yeah, I mean, you can find me on LinkedIn, of course. And our website is cosmiccentors.com. Thank you so much. And by the way, from day one as a company, we've made it our mission to make our knowledge accessible to as many people as possible. So right now you're seeing the link to, we have more than 220 articles. We have more than 25 worksheets you can download that use our methodology and our approach. So please come many. The team will be very happy to see that. Just reach out to me on LinkedIn or through our website, and I'll be happy to have a chat about your challenges and maybe help you make better decisions.
And just for the listeners who are not seeing the video, can you read the link?
Yeah. So it's Cosmic Centaurs, Cosmic Centaurs, centaurs like the mythical creature, .com/resources. Yeah, I look forward to hearing from all of you and getting feedback on this episode. It was really great. I have to say one thing before we wrap up is that I always say you can judge a person not by the quality of their answers, but by the quality of their questions. And I'm very grateful that you took the time to prepare such meaningful questions for me.
Thank you so much, Marilyn. It means a lot to me. And I want to also say thank you to Navid, Leon, and everybody else who's been joining the and engaging with the conversation. This is part of the reason we want to, you know, involve people to be part of the discussion and hopefully provide as much value for everybody listening. So thank you, Marilyn, once again. And to everybody else, see you once again at the next episode of Productivity Mastery. Be blessed. Thank you guys for listening. Make sure to subscribe to my monthly newsletter by visiting stoyanyankov.com and also learn about the Perform methodology and the Perform book, as well as our various personal and team coaching offers. Stay tuned and keep performing.